Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Instant content, inexpensive products, and the environmental benefits of paper-free reading. That's a lot to offer the modern-day bookworm. But the old-fashioned product, you know, the one that gave rise to the beetle larva that feeds on the paper and glue and books, still is popular, more popular than the electronic cousins, according to a new Pew Research Center report on reading trends. Joining us now by phone is Director of Internet Science and Technology Research at Pew Research Center, Lee Rainey. Welcome back, Lee.
Thanks so much, Ann.
Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Are you an e-reader devotee, or do you prefer the feel of a well-worn paperback? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, but do it right away. So what are the numbers when we compare print and e-books, Lee Rainey?
Since 2011, we've been asking people about their reading habits, and that was the dawn of the e-book reader era and the e-book era. So we've been interested in tracking how it's changed people's reading habits, and sure enough, it has. So in 2011, 17% of American adults had read an e-book in the past year. Now it's up to 28%. But probably the more surprising part of the story to a lot of your listeners, Anne, is that printed books, that thing that's been around for centuries, still way outshines e-books. 65% of American adults have read a printed book in the past year, compared with that 28% who had read an e-book. Overall, if we ask about all different formats, whether you've read a printed book or an e-book or listened to an audio book, about three-quarters of adults did that in the past 12 months. So these numbers have been pretty steady over time. There's been a rise in e-books, but it has not taken away from the thing that has captivated generations of people, the printed book.
Let's talk about the demographics a little bit, specifically age. Does that make a difference?
Amazingly enough, it doesn't. There are very few people who are digital only. So book readers tend to take whatever format is available to them and whatever seems to be convenient or enchanting at the moment. So there aren't stupendous demographic differences when it comes to different book reading habits, at least by age. The surprising thing is that younger adults, those who are age 18 to 29, are more likely than their elders to have read any kind of book in the past year, more likely to have read a printed book, and a little bit more likely to have read an e-book, but they're very close to those who are in Gen X. So the bigger story here is that young adults still continue to read books in a variety of forms, and they are more likely, especially more likely than older Americans, 65 and older, to have read any format of book.
Wow. That's a surprise.
Well, it is. And, of course, all of us know senior citizens that are very avid book readers. They go to libraries. They go to book fairs. Yeah. They frequent bookstores a lot. And so those who are into it are really into it. But it gets harder for some older folks as they age to do reading. And, again, sort of if you go back a decade or maybe a little longer ago than a decade, two things were predicted. First of all, young people would never read books again. And, secondly, that e-books would surpass printed books as the favored format. Neither things have happened.
My 85-year-old mother loves her e-book. Loves it. She can't use her cell phone, but she loves her e-book.
Yeah. Well, and it's a common thing now for children and grandchildren to give their senior citizen family member, a parent or a grandparent, an e-book reader. And those who are into it are quite into it. They like the convenience. It's a pretty easy set of devices to use. It's easy to carry around. It doesn't weigh as much as a book. So it's definitely not the case that seniors are not into this stuff. They're not quite at the same level as younger adults, but it's still a broad phenomenon that's sweeping through every demographic in the country.
Huh. All right. So why are e-books relevant then? Is it because of that broad appeal?
Well, they're relevant because books are relevant. Let's start with that.
Okay.
I mean, as a form of knowledge dissemination and as a form of entertainment and enrichment, there's probably few things that rival the book as a way to transport people in their imaginations or help them learn things. And it's a very familiar form. People have grown up with books. Let's say this. They're an amazing technology. Ink on paper between hardbound covers or soft covers, very transportable, very shareable, very convenient, very social. You can mark them up and share your notes and things like that. And so the ebooks have just built on that popularity and that longstanding human interest in books. And books as a form of communication are still pretty popular. People want narrative forms. They want coherent pattern recognition. They want to be told stories, and books are a surpassingly good way to do that.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the ebook and how it ranks in our priorities when it comes to reading. You're listening to Lee Rainey. He's Director of Internet Science and Technology Research at Pew Research Center. They've just released a new report on the ebook and where it lands in our priorities. As I said, are you an ebook devotee? Do you prefer the feel of a well-worn paperback? Do you like both, as I do? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How many people are using their smartphones to read a book on? I wouldn't like that, but how many people do it?
13% of adults now do it.
That's
about
a lot.
Three times as many as were doing it in 2011 when we started this work. Tablet computers are also on the rise. 15% of adults read e-books on tablet computers. What's kind of, well, the big story there, of course, is that these convenient, transportable body parts, basically our cell phone is another limb on our body in many cases, they're an easy way to consume books when you're in crowded circumstances, when you need something that's light to carry, when you're trying to kill a little time between meetings or waiting for a bus or in line at a store. So the cell phone, the smartphone in particular, has become a popular way for people to dose themselves with books. We watch people toggle between different devices. So they'll read part of a book on a cell phone, they'll read part of it on a tablet, they'll read part of it on an ebook reader, and there are features now in ebooks where you can sync up to the most recent page that you've read on whatever device you're reading it on. So it's a pretty convenient way to consume a book.
Are there any different other demographic issues besides age? For instance, it's interesting that African Americans and Latinos tend to use cell phones as primary forms of reading. Why is that? What do we know?
Yeah, all of our research, so we look at broad uses of technology, and this particular research focused on books, but we see that African Americans, Latinos, and poor people of any race are especially likely to privilege their smartphone over other devices for getting information. Part of that is that for some people, it's the only digital device that they really have in their lives. Another reason for it, of course, is you're only going to have one device, or you're only going to be able to afford to pay for one device and one connection plan. A smartphone gives you so many options. It's like the Swiss Army knife of communications. You can play games on it. You can read books on it. You can get email on it. You can read the news on it. You can get health information on it. And so particularly for African Americans and Latinos, these are enormously important features for these all-purpose devices.
And as far as e-reading goes, you can't beat the price.
Well, it tends to be a little bit cheaper. The other thing that people say that's compelling about ebooks is how convenient it is to get them. So you can literally be walking onto a bus or walking onto a plane or walking out your front door, and by the time they close the door on the plane or you shut your front door, you can have the book in front of you. The other thing that people really appreciate is the convenience of being able to carry around multiple books in one device. And so there are lots of ways that the lightness of ebooks is capturing people.
And you can sample a book too.
Yeah. There are ways that you can sort of get a pre-seed or read reviews of other books in a really interesting way. And of course, when you buy any kind of book now, you get recommendations about other kinds of books, and often that's a spur for people to get convenient access to books and things like that. But when you talk to people about printed books, you know, the thing that really sort of distinguishes them from ebooks is the sort of memories of curling up in a nice chair with a book, or reading to a child, or having really solitary moments on the beach or something like that. So there are ways that people really rhapsodize about that very familiar experience of reading a printed book, and it doesn't look like that's going to go away anytime soon.
John in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hi, Ann. So I just wanted to mention, you asked about people who like both, and I still really love the feel of a book in my hand. But I find if I'm traveling or if I have a really long book, I tend to prefer the ebook. It seems more convenient and it's a lot lighter.
Do you use, I don't know if it's Amazon or what, but where people highlight sections of the book? Do you see that?
Yeah, I have a Kindle, and I've used that feature a lot, especially if I'm reading something technical.
That's kind of interesting. It's sort of like a crowdsourcing kind of a thing. I mean, you get to see what other people think are interesting in that. Lee Rainey, did that come up in your research? And John, thank you so much.
Yes, not in the data, Ann, but when you talk to people in focus groups and other kinds of circumstances, that's one of the really nice features of ebooks that now is sort of baked into the process. It's kind of like being in a book group that you might not necessarily be in the same room reading the same passage at the same time, but you see what others have felt about that passage. And those passages seem to sort of call out to you from the screen to sort of pay special attention to me because others have highlighted it and either, you know, fought with it or or felt good about it or something like that. So there's a very sort of social experience with people who share their underlinings with others in their ebooks.
What about gender? Does that make a difference in your research?
Yeah, women are more likely than men to read in every format, although listening to audiobooks, men and women are pretty much the same. And that holds through a whole lot of other ways that we talk to folks, for instance, about libraries. Women are more likely to be library users than men. But again, it's a lot of people in both genders. It's 77% of women, 68% of men have read a book in the past year. And so it's a very powerful experience for people across the board.
Are there with the shift to a digital native world in which children and teens have always had access to the online world, what do the numbers tell us about ebook reading in the future?
Well, it's an interesting thing to try to anticipate, in part because the idea of a book and the notion of a book reading experience is an evolving experience. There are a lot of really interesting things and innovations going on in publishing houses that are trying to see whether the book experience should, for instance, be a multimedia experience or be a linked experience where in an ebook you can go off out of the context of the book and do background reading on the era in which the book takes place or the phenomenon that the book is describing or the kind of relationships that the book is exploring. So there are lots of innovations that are going on that will make the idea of book reading probably a different thing in the future, and the experience of book reading a very different thing in the future. But it's interesting to see in our data that printed books still have such sway on readers that what was a very commonplace prediction of 10 years ago, that ebooks are just going to dominate everything and the printed book will go away or become like a special artifact, like a handwritten letter, that's not happening anytime soon.
Jan from Centerburg in Knox County writes, she personally prefers the feel of books in her hands, but knows an elderly gentleman who prefers ebooks because he can change the font to a larger size and it is easier to see. That's something.
Yeah, it's very adaptable, and we hear, for instance, from people who, again, sort of love that tactile feel of a printed book under most circumstances, but if they're taking their kid to swimming practice or violin lessons or something like that, and they have to wait for a half an hour for the practice to end, the virtue of an ebook, even if it's being read on a small screen like a smartphone, is something that's really attractive to people.
Lee Rainey, thanks for joining us today. I always appreciate your insights from the Pew Research Center.
And I always like being on your show, Ann. Thank you so much.
Lee Rainey is Director of Internet Science and Technology Research at Pew Research Center. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Self-driving cars are just around the corner. If you live in Pittsburgh, that's literally just around the corner if you get one of the four recently dispatched by the ride-sharing company Uber. And yesterday, the Obama administration released safety guidelines for self-driving cars. And here in Columbus, the U.S. Department of Transportation has bestowed a Smart Cities grant that in part will go towards a fleet of self-driving vehicles. Tech writer Mike Murphy recently wrote about this latest phase of driverless road transportation for Quartz. He joins us now. Welcome back to the show, Mike Murphy.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
What's the significance that the Obama administration released those safety guidelines yesterday? I mean, how big of a deal is that, you know, beyond the details of them?
I think it's a pretty big deal. I mean, this is something that we've been expecting for a while. He and the Transportation Secretary, Anthony Fox, have been hinting at this since January. They put it in the budget that there was going to be all of this money released to kind of make it easier for self-driving cars to hit the roads. But given the week that we just had with Uber putting these cars on the road, Ford had a demonstration of its self-driving cars, and a few other automakers showed off self-driving tech last week, I think it's a really interesting time for the government to kind of step in and say, yes, we want to encourage this sort of innovation, but we also want to make sure that it's safe.
Are there a lot of existing regulations around the country?
There really aren't. There are currently, I think, 9 states that have some sort of regulations about self-driving cars. It gets trickier when you get down to like a city level because, for example, Pennsylvania, where Uber's tests are taking place, there isn't actually a Pennsylvania-wide regulation. The regulations in that case are determined by the city of Pittsburgh. The mayor there, Bill Peduto, has really been a kind of exponent for the technology. But then there are states like Florida, which recently passed a law saying that you don't even need a driver in the front seat. You know, we're still at a phase where we're kind of testing these cars, and yet Florida has already decided that we're good enough, we're far enough along that we don't even need to have drivers in the front of these cars. And then there's 8 other states that have kind of somewhere between those laws where there's a lot of, like, California requires there to be a driver in the front seat. He might not be driving the car, but he'll have his hands on the wheel, and then an engineer to the side of him tracking everything that's going on, and both of them can stop the car if need be.
Right. So it doesn't feel real driverless to me.
Well, Uber let me sit in the front seat of one, and it's weird because, you know, it's a Ford, and it feels very much like a Ford, and it drives like a Ford.
Uh-huh.
But. You know, I very quickly stopped paying attention to the road, and I was talking to the engineer who was sitting beside me. And thankfully, he was very well trained at making sure that his eyes were still on the road. Because it was crazy how quickly I forgot that I was in the front seat of a car. I was ostensibly in charge of the car, but the car was making all the decisions on its own, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah, as part of your reporting, you rode one of Uber's self-driving Uber cars. This is in Pittsburgh, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and Pittsburgh, I've gotten lost. I have relatives here, and I've gotten lost in Pittsburgh way more times than I want them to know about. It's crazy, that setup. I don't know who laid it out. But anyway, what a challenging city to start off with.
Yeah, and that was part of their intention. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why Uber chose Pittsburgh, partially because of Carnegie Mellon and all the robotics engineers that are there. But they made a big point of saying that basically if they can solve Pittsburgh, both with the crazy layout and also the weather, they can pretty much solve anywhere. That being said, the route that they took us on wasn't exactly, weaving through downtown Pittsburgh or going up any of the crazy hills or anything like that. We went from the Strip District, which is where Uber's lab is, which is a kind of post-industrial kind of area where there's not too much going on. Drove down the water, and then we went over a bridge and came back. And it was like a 5-mile trip, but we only made, I think, 5 turns or something like that. So it wasn't exactly like, a morning commute or something like that.
Is it identified as a self-driving car?
It is. There is a bit of livery on the car. It says something like uber.com/car, which if you go to it, it gives you more information. But, I mean, apart from that, it's somewhat obvious because especially this generation of cars, there's this giant set of cameras on the top and on the sides that, it looks like when they first released an image of this thing, back in May. It was like a black car, these black giant things on top that looked like Batmobile or something like that. But I mean, there's no actual indications, and the newer models will have far fewer cameras sticking out the sides of them. And even just last week, Volvo has rolled off their first autonomous cars, like production model cars, and you can't tell at all that these are self-driving cars just from looking at them.
The as far as the Uber cars in Pittsburgh, you said you went on like a 5-mile jaunt. Is that typical for the autonomous Uber cars in Pittsburgh, that they'll only do certain routes?
Yeah. So they've said that at least for the start, they're only going to go to a few areas near downtown and by the stadiums and obviously by their headquarters, like areas that their engineers and the cars have mapped very, very well, which allows them, you know, the cars can react to things that are going on in front of them as a regular driver would, but they're far more confident in the same way that, you know, you're more confident driving around your home and the blocks around your house versus somewhere you've never been before. So the cars, at least for these initial tests, are going to places they've mapped out super well.
Any mishaps along the way in your experience?
There weren't any mishaps. I know that a few other reporters that were there had some trouble starting the car and things like that, but not when I was driving, there was nothing wrong. But when the engineer was driving, there were a couple indications where the car would just make like a little ding or something. It was like a very quiet noise, which I thought was a little too quiet, that it wanted him to take over because it couldn't quite figure out what to do in the situation.
Uh-huh.
Like there was one instance where we were on a 2-lane road, both lanes traveling in the same direction, and there was nobody in front of us. And the car, for some reason, I think eventually it needed to make a left, so it moved into the left-hand lane, but there was a big truck parked there. So the car just sat behind the truck, didn't know what to do, and it dinged at the engineer to say, hey, I don't know what to do. So he went around the car and then back into the left lane, which just felt a little silly. Like, it, you know, considering it can do all this other stuff, it seemed weird that it, like, kind of made that decision.
And you said it was a very light ding, meaning if you had been talking loudly or had the radio on, you might not hear it, or...
Yeah, I mean, it was not exactly a blaring, like, you need to take control of this car or anything like that. It was just like, hey, you should drive now.
Dude, you're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking about autonomous cars. Uber just unveiled a 4-car fleet of autonomous cars in Pittsburgh. Mike Murphy test drove one of them. He is a tech reporter at Quartz. We'll have a link to his article about this on our website at wosu.org/allsides if you want to check it out. Have you driven an autonomous car? Well, that's kind of an oxymoron. Have you been a passenger in an autonomous car? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. They're out there. There's more of them than ever. And now there are federal guidelines for safety purposes in autonomous cars issued this week by the Obama administration. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How much advantage does this this launch by Uber in Pittsburgh give the company in the ride sharing business? Do you think, Mike Murphy?
I think for now it's a big deal, because especially in the ride sharing, there's, you know, Lyft is working on similar technology, but you know, we haven't seen any indication that they're going to be able to deploy anything anytime soon. And a lot of the automakers like Tesla and Ford have said, and Volvo have said, that they want to start ride-sharing services based on their autonomous cars.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them are either going to be 2 years away or 5 years away. So I think by Uber being a first mover, at the very least, it's a great branding move for them. That being said, if something happens, you know, they were the first movers. And you know.
Yeah. Is this an Uber-designed car, or did they work with someone else? What do you know about that?
So the car itself is a standard Ford Fusion, and all of the technology built on top of it is basically proprietary to Uber. They're using a lot of third-party technology, and actually a lot of the same technology that all these other companies are using. I asked them very explicitly, like, who are you working with? And they were pretty pretty quiet about that. But, I mean, some of the stuff you can see on the outside, like the radars and the kind of laser scanners that they use, are the same ones that Ford is using and Google has used in the past. But for their next version of the self-driving car, which they also showed off last week, they worked very closely with Volvo, who is working on its own self-driving initiative. So the next model looks a lot less like someone just took a regular Ford and then stuck a bunch of technology on top of it. It looks far more like, it actually looks almost like the top of a boat. Like, it looks like something that was very well designed to be sticking out. Whereas the one right now, it's just kind of this giant plinth that sits on top of the hood of the car.
Like something from Ghostbusters or something.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I thought of when I saw it. All right. And by the way, I mean, right now there's two people in the front seat. There's the driver who doesn't drive unless they have to. And then there's, as you said, the engineer. How long is that going to go on? I mean, when do they anticipate, you know, going driverless?
So Uber said that they plan to have two people in the front for the foreseeable future. But other companies have suggested that they can go driverless very soon. I mean, Lyft, their CEO wrote this kind of treatise on the next 5 to 10 years of self-driving cars, and he seemed very bullish that it will be literally in the next 5 to 10 years that we'll have completely driverless cars. And states like Florida are betting on that, as I said, but I'm inclined to believe that there will probably be hands on the wheels, human hands on the wheels for a fair bit longer.
Well, because I said at the top of the hour that Uber's betting that self-driving cars will cut out the middleman. That is the cost of human drivers. And I'm just wondering, I guess they have plenty of money to invest in this in the meantime?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's the long-term goal, definitely, because human capital is probably the most expensive part in this once you've got the technology up and running. I mean, there's always going to be, a group of engineers or a group of workers that are going to have to, work on these cars. But yeah, I mean, they have billions of dollars in the bank, and they see this. Uber CEO has called this an existential problem that they need to solve for the kind of long-term health of the business. Whether that's something they can figure out before they run out of cash or they need to IPO or something like that remains to be seen.
One of the things I've always liked about Uber, particularly if you're in a different town, is that it's someone to talk to about the town you're in. We had a lot of fun talking to Uber drivers in Nashville in June. It was part of the experience is meeting these people. Is that just because it's new? Uber is relatively new, and that we think that now, but eventually we won't care anything about our Uber driver. We might as well just get an autonomous car anyway.
I mean, it says a lot about, like, the state of the world when you do think about that, trying to autonomize everything about our lives.
Uh-huh.
And, you wonder if there will come a time when you really don't need to talk to anyone you've never met before, which is kind of disconcerting.
Well, Kurt Vonnegut's dealt with it, but other than that,
exactly.
Right?
And I don't know. I think that there will always probably be a place for that kind of, like, human service. I personally think that there will be specific applications for these type of autonomous cars versus a normal taxi service. Maybe a long time in the future, we won't have the humans involved. But, like, it does feel weird, especially, like, if something happens in the car. I mean, you want someone else to be there. Like, what happens if you're having a heart attack or you get sick in a self-driving car? Who's gonna help you, like, as you would have in a regular car? I don't know. Mm-hmm. It just seems weird.
Jim in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ian.
Go ahead.
Interesting conversation.
Thanks.
My question is, if you're going to have all these quote-unquote autonomous cars, all you're doing is trading one for one in terms of volume on the street. It seems to me that not everybody wants to go the same direction at the same time. Not everybody's going at the same moment. So all you do is replace one type of traffic jam with another type of traffic jam. Hmm. And it's always been my contention that some type of interurban or some type of express, like a train, in from the suburbs, let's say, going from New Albany to downtown, where you can move 1,000 people within a matter of a few minutes, sure seems to beat having an autonomous car caught in a snowstorm that can't go any faster than any other car caught on the ice and snow.
Mike Murphy, Jim's. This is an issue that's been dealt with. Mike Murphy, tell us what the Uber or the driverless car proponents or whatever say is the answer to that question.
So, I mean, there's a few answers. Firstly, Uber is going to look into kind of long haul, long distance, bigger stuff. They bought this company, Otto, which is a self-driving truck company, to think about those kind of long distance problems. But in the self-driving car mindset, the idea is that these cars will always be running and they'll all be electric. So they'll, if they're not on the road to find some new passenger, they'll be back charging. And then there'll just be this constant cycle of always being in use. Whereas when a car is out of use, like an Uber is out of use, it's out of use. Meaning theoretically, you could have, like right now, people have to sleep, but these cars would never have to sleep and they never have to stop going unless they need to charge. So theoretically, you would need fewer cars to complete the same number of trips. That's the ideal. But as your call-in said, they're still going to get stuck in the same snowstorms. And they're still working. Ford is doing a lot of work. Obviously, they're up in Michigan. They're trying to figure out how a self-driving car sees in the snow, because obviously that's a much harder problem for radar and lasers to see through like a blizzard. Right now, the answer is they won't drive in bad weather. Mm-hmm. But yeah, long term, I don't know necessarily if this is replacing public transport, though the Department of Transportation has definitely thought about this as a kind of, public transport of the future where mm-hmm. everything is modular and always moving. I don't think the answer is necessarily going to be Uber. Answering this, Uber will be an on-demand service, a slightly nicer, more expensive service than maybe, a self-driving bus system. Maybe the rapid transit systems of the future are all automated in very similar ways. But with all of this sort of technology, with any kind of new, different technology, it's always going to impact people with money first, because then they can prove that it's valuable and then scale down from there to cheaper products and that sort of thing. That's why Tesla is some of the most popular the first mover in electric vehicles. It's the same kind of deal. Once the technology is proven at a luxury level, then it tends to trickle down to a wider audience. I think autonomous technology will be the exact same.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Time for just one more. And Martha in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Martha.
Hi. Up until this summer, I lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan, mm-hmm. and they've been running driverless cars in the city for quite a while now. Mm-hmm. I've been behind a driverless car, and it's very scary and sort of unpredictable.
You mean when nobody was in it?
When you're behind it,
yeah.
They brake at a different speed than a human would.
Like how?
And when they make a turn, well, it's hard to explain. Maybe it's a faster stop.
Okay.
From what I've seen, especially when they turn, though, instead of making a gradual turn like a human would, they sort of make this 90-degree turn.
Like I did when I first got my driver's license, yeah? Yeah?
Yeah, maybe that's how it is. It does sort of have that feeling like you're driving behind a new driver, and there isn't any label on them. And I had to ask my friends, what this thing was and all this stuff on it. And that's how I found out it was a self-driving car.
Interesting. Martha, thanks for calling.
Hey, you're welcome.
Yeah. Mike Murphy, thank you for joining us today. As always, appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Murphy is a tech reporter at Quartz, and we will post a link to his article about the autonomous Uber cars in Pittsburgh. They've launched a fleet of four so far. If you want to learn more about that, check out the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up with Russell Holley from AndroidCentral.com. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Every parent has to decide how much screen time to allow their children, access to and when to give kids their own smartphone. But when that time does come, it can be confusing with many, many options out there. Joining us now with tips on choosing a smartphone for young users is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Before we get into your specific recommendations, what are some of the things that you look for in general when choosing a smartphone for your kids?
The biggest thing that I look for when choosing something for my kids to use, and I feel like that's an important distinction, is it's choosing something for my kids to use, not choosing something for them to have and feel like it belongs to them, which was a distinction that I kind of felt like I needed to make as a parent. But the biggest thing that I needed was something that was just incredibly simple. You know, it did not have a ton of features bolted onto it. It wasn't something that included a bunch of different logins for third-party services, you know, so something that came with a whole bunch of extra apps, you know, that were included so that people could try out new services. I tend to stay away from that so that there's no encouragement to you know, try things that I wouldn't, you know, have kind of guided my children into trying. And also something that is, you know, designed to be secure, something that's getting regular software updates and make sure that it's, you know, constantly protecting them from the kind of data that they would otherwise share.
I wanted to step back a second and get to this distinction you made about something they're going to use versus something they're going to have.
Yeah, so this is kind of a personal parenting thing. I am in a weird situation personally where I don't, we haven't had a landline in our house in over 10 years. The cell phone was kind of all that was necessary. And over the summer, my girls reached an age where their friends needed a phone number to call. And so my phone number was the default number that got given out. And I started getting phone calls, you know, from 7 a.m. until 9 p.m. at night from kids who wanted to talk to my daughters. And so I pretty quickly needed to make some decisions as far as what to get them as a phone. And after some consideration, I went with a phone that they can, you know, kind of check out from me, that they can borrow from me when they need to go places or when they need to make a specific phone call. But the one that comes back to me pretty frequently, instead of living with them as something that they own and take care of, it's something that, you know, I am, you know, primarily the one who, you know, keeps charged and keeps a hold of. But when they need it, they take it from me.
Why the distinction? Why is that important to you?
Well, I feel like for two reasons. One, it's really easy to, have that phone as kind of almost like bragging rights, you know, as, you know, and my kids are at an age, it's, 11 and 9, where they're starting to encounter other kids who have, you know, started bringing cell phones to school and started using cell phones in inappropriate ways in school, you know, cheating on class and playing games when they're not supposed to and things like that. And I'm generally interested in discouraging that behavior.
And nobody has bigger bragging rights than your kids, I would imagine. I mean, they got it all.
It takes a lot of restraint, you know, teaching that restraint when kids are like, oh, I got this phone. And they're like, oh, my dad's had that phone for 3 weeks now. Like, it's not healthy behavior, you know. And I had to, so I'm like constantly having that conversation with kids. You know, this is not a one-up thing. Your dad does not own all of these things. He just tries all of these things. It's an important distinction. Do not brag to your friends that your dad has all of these toys.
I think it'd be pretty cool to have a dad like you if I were a kid today. Your top pick is Google's Nexus 5. Tell us about why you like it for kids.
Well, the Nexus 5X is comparably inexpensive when compared to a lot of the other phones that are out there. It's a $299 phone that comes in a couple of different colors. So there are some options if your kid does not want, you know, kind of the flat white or the flat black phone. It is super simple to figure out how to use. There is no extra software on there. It is pretty much the flat stock Google experience and has some additional security features on there, you know, fingerprint scanner. It has very up-to-date software. It's updated once a month per, Google's, you know, kind of update system. And it has a really nice camera on it for a phone this inexpensive, which is, you know, maybe not the most important thing, but still a nice thing to have.
You wrote that this one might be a little overkill for my first smartphone. How so? What do you mean?
most phones that you find in that $300 price range or you know, just shy of that $300 price range do not have, you know, cameras this nice or fingerprint sensors this nice or even, you know, screens that are, you know, displays that are quite this quality. You know, Google worked really hard with partners to get the price down on this particular phone when it launched this year, really as competition with Apple when they were doing the their smaller phone this year. And so this is really a phone that is great for anybody, much less, you know, the first phone for a child.
Your best value phone, if price is the concern, is the Moto G4 from Amazon. Why? I mean, what's the price and why is it a good option?
So this is normally a $200 phone that gets marked down to $150 if you buy it from Amazon, because Amazon front loads it with Amazon-specific ads, which can be disabled. But it's another phone that, with exception to the Amazon services, has very few extra pieces of software on it. And for $150 is something that you can buy and works on any network in the United States. So you don't have to buy something specifically from Verizon or from AT&T or T-Mobile. And you can just plug your SIM card into this and have it start working immediately.
So Amazon, you're saying it brings ads to the table, but it's easy to disable those.
Yeah.
Okay. And your recent article focused on Android phones. How would you rate Apple iPhones as first phones for kids?
I think Apple products are just very expensive. So you kind of have to have that mindset going in. If you are you know, able or interested in spending that money, then that's fine. The iPhone 5C is you know, one phone that is probably less expensive, but also the iPhone Special Edition that came out this past year that kind of looks like the original iPhone 5 is another one of those kind of smaller phones that is, you know, typically less expensive. But if you're buying something straight from Apple, you're buying one of the newer iPhones, they're just significantly more expensive than these other options.
What about hand-me-downs?
That's always a great option if you have it available. You know, it's tough. You know, the frequency with which people drop phones and shatter screens and use them to upgrade makes it difficult for me to lean on that as kind of a recommendation. And you often find, you know, depending on how old the phone is, there are some concerns with software updates if the phone is more than, say, 2 years old. Then those phones typically do not continue to get software and security updates, which can be a concern when you have, you know, kids that are using Facebook and things like that.
You also recently wrote about choosing smartwatches for kids, and your top pick was the VTech KittyZoom Smartwatch DX. And of course, VTech is familiar because it was sort of that first kids computer thingy.
Yeah, this is and you know, so they continue with this where it's not really a smartwatch so much as it is a toy that, you know, has a screen where you the kid can press buttons, and there are some neat little features like a very low quality camera that's built into it. And, you know, I started having people asking me what smartwatch would be good for their kids, and I kind of had to take a step back when I heard that question, because smartwatches from my perspective are, you know, $250 to $500 accessories
they're a luxury
that, yeah, adults don't need, much less a child. But it turns out that there are actually some really neat kind of kid toys out there that let, you know, children kind of emulate their parents. They see, you know, mom or dad walking around with a smartwatch and doing things on their smartwatch. These are nice, you know, relatively inexpensive toys that allow them to emulate that. But beyond that, there are also some options that act as, you know, kind of surrogate phones with tracking abilities built into them.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, so the KittyZoom is really more of a toy, but Verizon and AT&T both offer actual smartwatches aimed at kids called the Gizmo Pal 2 and the Philip 2. And both of them are watches that can make phone calls, and they have special apps that are built into the parent's phone that allow them to track the child's whereabouts via GPS and make phone calls to the kids on the watch. And in some cases, I think the Philip 2 has one that allows the connection to just happen immediately, where the phone call is placed and the watch just answers without the child interacting. For a, you know, security feature, if you're not really sure where your child is, then you can kind of gain the audio from that environment and go from there.
Huh, that's interesting. Now, does a kid need to know about all of this or not necessarily?
For the most part, it's just a watch that they would wear that tells time and gives things like calendar appointments. And the Gizmo Pal 2 is the more functional of the two, in my opinion, in that it gives the ability to send some quick messages back to the parent. These are preloaded messages that are built into the watch, so you can say things like, you know, soccer practice is over or something like that to notify the parent to kind of interact. But You know, for the most part, these are kind of, I jokingly called them, you know, passive tracking bracelets for your children in the thing, because it's, you know, and for the most part, that's what they feel like. You know, this is, these are tracking bracelets for kids you don't quite trust with phones yet.
Well, all right. So now that you've taken a step back, since people asked you about smartwatches for kids, would you recommend starting a child with a smartwatch before a smartphone, or would it just depend?
It really depends on the environment. You know, if you are in a situation where you have a kid who is, you know, constantly at kind of extracurricular activities, and you know, the time is kind of inconvenient, or they're in a space where they might go to a friend's house afterwards, and that's something that you're comfortable with as a parent, then this gives, you know, kind of a really quick way to maintain communication and to know where your child is, you know, kind of whenever you feel like you need to. On the other hand, I feel like the age gap between you know, one of these wristwatches and a smartphone that had, you know, kind of limited capabilities and some parental monitoring software on it, is really only a year or two. So it's kind of a limited group between these two kinds of devices. And it really just depends on how the parent feels like interacting with the child.
Hmm. Christmas comes every year, though, Russell Holly. All right. So users of the new iPhones are reporting buzzing or hissing sounds. What's going on with that?
So every year we get a new iPhone, and every year there's like a week or two where everything is terrible with that iPhone as far as news reports go. And reality tends to be just a little bit different with just about each year, with exception to when the phones were bending.
I'm sorry.
A notable exception. This version of the iPhone has some really interesting issues with a buzzing sound that was coming from the headphone speaker. A couple of people were reporting it as a problem that was happening, and it turns out that it's not so much a problem as the exact same thing that's been happening with every iPhone for a while. This was something that my colleagues at iMore, they found the exact same buzzing sound from the headphone jack. It's specifically like when you're not listening to, I'm sorry, I said the headphone jack. I meant the speaker port on the top
okay.
of the phone.
All right,
because the iPhone does not have a headphone jack. This buzzing sound coming from the you know, earbud speaker when you hold it up to your ear, even when a call is not happening, it's just this faint buzzing sound in the background. And it's actually been on every version of the iPhone since the iPhone 4. It's really just the part that they're using is kind of always on so that it can very quickly play notification tones and things like that. And so there's this faint kind of noise in the background. But it's definitely not a new thing. It's not worse because it's the iPhone 7. If you have read something about this, it really is not a big deal at all.
Okay. But there has to be a deal because it's new. So that's the deal.
Yeah, every new iPhone has something. You know, that is terribly wrong, and it's the end of the world until it's not.
We just have a few minutes left, but you wanted to talk about 3D printing, and you want to talk specifically about the M3D micro printer. It's very small, sort of affordable. What's the deal?
Yeah, so this is a big part of what we've kind of been talking about it for 2 years now when it comes to 3D printing was, you know, when 3D printers reached a point where they were kind of user-friendly enough and were affordable enough that, you know, they became something that could be recommended almost as Christmas presents.
Mm-hmm.
And the Micro 3D is the first one that I found that actually fits the bill. It is very small. It can sit on your desk or even on like a corner, you know, corner end table or something like that. They come in a variety of colors. The software is very easy to use, and they start at $350, and in some cases I've actually seen them on sale for $300.
Mm-hmm.
With you know, just really easy to use software. It was really impressive to see that this was something that, you know, anyone in my house could sit down and immediately use, and the print quality of the products that came out of it were really nice.
$350 still is expensive. Is it something for your budding engineer, maybe, or something like that, a designer, that kind of a person?
This is definitely something for someone that you're considering, you know, who would want this kind of accessory. This isn't something that you would get as just kind of a random gift for someone. So, yeah, if it's
this isn't the GoPro here. Okay.
Right.
All right. Well, Russell Holly, maybe that'll come up on our Christmas list coming up later this year, our gift giving guide coming up later this year. But in any event, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holley, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. He joins us every Tuesday on Tech Tuesday. We've been lucky to have him for lo these many years. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.